It's working. All right. Okay. We can turn this one off in a way. And now we'll have this recorded for a much bigger class that attends here in the virtual world. So, you know, this isn't the whole class. This is a small part of the class. So that's why we appreciate our tech guys here and make sure we get things recorded. So, all right. And gals, sorry. back to the planets. So, as I mentioned, there's a book, Rare Earth, written by Peter Ward, an atheist paleontologist, and Don Brownlee, an agnostic astronomer, who concludes that there may indeed be many planets that would have the possibility of perhaps supporting bacterial life for a brief moment during their history, but the possibility of finding a planet that could have advanced life on it would be extremely rare or non-existent, with the probable likelihood that in spite of the vast size of the universe, Earth would be alone in its capacity to sustain advanced life. And the problem is you've got people searching for these planets who think if they simply find a planet with a possibility for water at some point, that means that it's a good shot that it could have life on it. Water, as I've mentioned here in the class before, is the second most abundant molecule in the universe. It's everywhere in the universe. The only molecule more abundant than water would be molecular hydrogen. Makes sense because the universe is 75% hydrogen in terms of its ordinary matter. But water literally is everywhere, and we have found a few Goldilocks planets. And what we mean by a Goldilocks planet is a planet that's approximately the size of the Earth, usually within three times the mass of the Earth, and within, say, a factor or two of the Earth's distance from its star, which means that if you're prepared to adjust the atmosphere by some radical amount, there would be the possibility it could have liquid water on its surface. And they actually found one that's about 2.5 times the mass of the Earth, where they have, based on its density, a very high probability that it's got water on its surface. But what they discovered is the amount of water it has is huge, somewhere between 10 and 50%. Earth, by comparison, has between 0.02 and 0.03% water. And so what's unique about the Earth is that it's extremely water poor. It's also extremely carbon poor. And so that's the other mantra that people searching for planets with a possibility for life. They're chasing the water and they're chasing the carbon. In my opinion, they need to do the opposite. They need to search for things that are really scant in their quantity of both carbon and water. And just to give you a point of comparison, these planets that they're finding, where they have the
I think it's doing something, but it's off.
I don't know what's going on. Yeah. The two planets that they found where they've been able to measure the density and get some idea of the atmosphere of the planet that were within, say, a factor three times the mass of the Earth, one came in as extremely water-rich, the other came in as extremely carbon-rich. And actually, if you look at the amount of carbon on the surface of the Earth and the crust of the Earth, compared to the amount of carbon we see elsewhere in the universe, For small bodies, Earth has 2,400 times less carbon. So we're extremely carbon poor. And because we're so carbon poor, our atmosphere is not dominated by methane, carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide. If it was, life would be impossible on the surface of our planet. But because we're so extremely carbon poor, we have very little of these molecules in our atmosphere. And this is what makes possible advanced life. And there's a number of reasons why we come in so extremely carbon poor. It has to do with the amazing history of the early Earth, the moon forming event and the late heavy bombardment, and also the way our sun formed, forming in a very giant cluster of galaxies where it got super enriched by heavy elements from three different kinds of supernova and from a special class of what we call asymptotic giant branch stars. And then got kicked out. What's really interesting about the birth of our sun is that it was born in one of these very rich clusters of stars where fortuitously the sun happened to be in the vicinity of exploding supernova eruptions and these asymptotic giant branch stars and also white dwarf binaries, which gave us the elements we need for advanced life. But fortuitously, our sun was not too close to these bodies, otherwise it would have been destroyed. And it wasn't too far away from those bodies, otherwise it wouldn't have got adequately enriched with the elements that Earth has that makes advanced life possible and technology possible. And then once it got enriched, it got kicked out violently from that cluster of stars, because if we remained there, the nearby stars would have disturbed our planetary system. But the point is, we have evidence that the Earth got a gravitational kick and literally was ejected quickly from that star cluster right after it got all the necessary enrichment. Then you get the moon-forming event, the late heavy bombardment. That really explains to a large degree why Earth is so unique in its distribution of molecules and elements. And what's really amazing is, I don't know if I've ever done this with you before, but actually gone through the periodic table and kind of show you the abundance that the Earth has and the abundance we expect in the rest of the universe. And in every category, Earth is anomalous. Where we have, say, 60 times less sulfur, where we have 40 times as much titanium, where we have 16,000 times as much uranium, 23,000 times as much thorium, and 2,400 times less carbon, and 500 to 1,000 times less water. And all these characteristics make possible the existence of advanced life here on planet Earth.
Get that on your website somewhere?
Yeah, I've got an article on our website. I've got three articles that I wrote about the unique distribution of elements here on planet Earth. Yeah, that's permanently up on our website. And incidentally, Earth is unique with respect to the other solar system planets. I wasn't planning to talk about this, but I can. In terms of Mars, we now know Mars has 60 times the sulfur that the Earth has. And because it's got 60 times as much sulfur, it rules Mars out as a candidate for life. That quantity of sulfur will make the surface and the crust so acidic, there's no possibility for the origin of life, and even if you put life there, it's not going to survive. So you don't want to have too much sulfur. You had your hand up first, so go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of things. If there is life on one of these planets, and they're finding them, looks like a bunch of them every week, how are we going to, maybe we can tell, maybe they're in the Goldilocks zone, but how are we going to tell that there's life? There's any kind of life in there. How can you detect that so far away? And also, the Goldilocks sort of thing is, for us, I mean, it's only going to last a few million years, and the sun is growing bigger and bigger all the time, so it's not really going to be a Goldilocks zone very long in cosmic time, where we'll be wiped out, crisp, bright, toasted.
Well, that's one of the unique features of the Earth, is it stays in a Goldilocks zone for billions of years. These other planets that we're discovering, they're saying conceivable liquid water. What that means is they look at the planet's characteristics and say, okay, these are the range of atmospheric models that are conceivable for that planet. And they choose the best one to get liquid water. But the ones they're discovering so far, it's such that that atmosphere would not be stable. And so you get liquid water for a brief period of time, and then it either goes into the frozen state or the vapor state. As I mentioned, it's critical you have it in all three states if you want to have life possible on that planet, certainly advanced life. And I'm predicting that within 10 years, they'll have found 10,000 Goldilocks planets, but zero with the capacity to support life.
Because there was 600 years ago, this planet here was a snowball. It was they call it a snowball Earth. It was covered with snow. You could ski from the North Pole to the South Pole.
Well, not quite.
Far less.
Yeah, there's something like, there's three snowball events we know for sure, and there might be as many as eight. But the evidence tells us that you've got a maximum of 90% of the planet's surface covered with ice. And when you're looking at these other planets, you're going to have these snowball events. I mean, there's different things that happens in the Earth's history that cools the planet down, which, for example, you cross a spiral arm, that's going to drop the temperature. There'll be climatic cycles which could drop the temperature. And so you get these snowball events. That would be for planets capable of sustaining life for a long period of time. And you mentioned the reason. The sun gets progressively brighter as it ages. And so the challenge is, how do you maintain life on planet Earth for 3.8 billion years when the sun is getting brighter and brighter as it gets older and older? No problem with planet Earth if you're talking unicellular life forms or colonies of unicellular life. They can tolerate these snowball events. We can't, but they can. And the last snowball event was a little bit before the Cameron explosion. The sun is now too bright for Earth to get another snowball event. So there's no risk of a future snowball event because the sun is now too bright to allow that to happen. And, you know, I've written in my book, More Than a Theory, God waited till the last snowball event to introduce advanced life. Because after all, advanced life doesn't do well with snowball events. Bacteria, no problem. And the other thing about planet Earth is, it's got the plate tectonic activity to deliver the planet from a snowball event. That's not true of Mars. That's not true of these planets that we're discovering. You need extremely strong, long-lasting plate tectonic activity in order for a planet to recover from a snowball event. The most likely scenario is you get a snowball event, covers the entire planet, and it's permanent ice. And the problem there is that you know, if you've got liquid water on the surface of the planet and you start turning it into ice, the ice and the snow reflect heat from the star much more efficiently than the liquid water does, or the continents would. And so that means that the planet gets cooler, and if it gets cooler, more ice forms, and once the planet is completely covered with ice, it reflects so much heat away you can't melt the thing. Unless you're on a planet like Earth, with a planet like Earth, plate tectonic activity will continue to release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So if you get enough volcanic activity during the snowball event, soon the carbon dioxide rises to a point where it traps enough heat to melt the ice. And so Earth recovered from all of its snowball events thanks to the fact that it's a planet with aggressive volcanic activity where the volcanism never shuts down. Unlike Venus, it gets volcanoes, but the volcanoes will shut down.
These other planets, which must be millions or trillions of them, were probably formed the same way that Earth and our planets were.
No, that's not true. What we're discovering is they formed by a very different mechanism.
Well, wouldn't they have a molten core like Earth has in the formation of these planets around the cosmos?
Well, one of the things we're discovering, looking at these extrasolar planets where we can actually determine what kind of atmosphere they have, is that compared to the solar system planets, they're very rich in volatiles, which is a technical term for gaseous molecules, you know, light molecules in its atmosphere. And what we now know is that our solar system, or a star, the sun, and its nascent planets, formed in the vicinity of these supernova eruptions that literally bathed the early solar system in a huge quantity of aluminum-26. Aluminum-26 is a short-lived radiometric element. It decays literally within a few million years. I think it's like even less than a million years. But what it does is it keeps the nascent solar system very hot, which drives off the volatiles, which explains why we have these rocky planets with small atmospheres. But this is not what we're finding in these extrasolar planets that we're discovering. They're all coming in volatile rich. And so what's unique is that our solar system happened to form under unique circumstances which caused it to be volatile poor. Now, they did find the first rocky planet. That was discovered, in fact, I made an announcement about it at the Sunday Morning Skeptics Forum, where they discovered the first definitively rocky planet outside of our solar system. But they found it orbiting its star, where it was so close to its star, it was orbiting every 21 hours. So that meant it was so close to its star that the heat of the star drove off all the volatiles. In fact, this would be a planet with no atmosphere at all. Being that close to its star, the atmosphere would be completely driven away. And as they measured the density of this planet, it came in at 8.8 grams per cubic centimeter, compared with about 5.85 for planet Earth. Until now, Earth has been the densest planet we discovered anywhere. This is a planet that's denser than the Earth, but in a way that we wouldn't entirely anticipate just from standard physics. This thing is close, so close to its star that the only elements that would have ever condensed to make the star would be extremely heavy elements. So yeah, we would expect that it would be that density. And a rule of thumb in physics is the farther you are away from the star, or put it more accurately, the cooler you are where your planet is forming, the less dense your planet will be. And so if you take Earth out of the equation, you see this beautifully laid out in our solar system. The farther away the planets are, the less dense they are. Earth is the kind of the sore thumb that sticks out. I mean, Mercury is almost as dense as the Earth, but it's supposed to be because it's so close to the Sun. Earth is the anomaly. It's got a much higher density than what we would expect, and more than double what we'd expect, but that's because of the moon-forming event and the late heavy bombardment that its density got pushed up as high as it is. The rest of the planets in our solar system have the densities we would expect, given the birthplace and given how far away those planets are the star, the Sun. So, go ahead.
I'm sure you've explained this before, but explain how it is the Earth is water poor when we're covered with so much water.
Okay. It's the moon-forming collision event. And so when the Earth was about 30 million years old, there was another planet in the same orbit of the Earth. You know, one thing you learn when you study classical mechanics is that any orbit about a body, there's a Lagrange point where you could conceivably have a second body in the same orbit where the orbit would be stable. So it's something we all study in third year physics. And the Lagrange points are 120 degrees back. So technically, you could have three planets sharing the same orbit every 120 degrees. Now, it's stable if it's what you would call a big, massive body like a star with just the one orbit about that star with three planets in that orbit. It's not stable if you've got bigger planets in the same system. And that would have been the problem for our solar system. You've got Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And so if you have a second planet at the Lagrange point of the Earth's orbit, that Lagrange point in due time will be moved a little bit. And once you move it to, say, 119.5 degrees as a result of a perturbation from the gravity of the big planets in our solar system, that's enough to start a slow creep. And what happens is the planet will gradually creep along the orbit and move towards the Earth. And so the latest scenario developed by the astronomer Robin Canupe actually determines that there is a planet about twice the mass of Mars, which would be a little less of one quarter the mass of the Earth, at the Lagrange point, and Jupiter and Saturn and the other planets caused it to jiggle a bit from that Lagrange point, and then it very slowly creeped along the orbit and headed towards the Earth, which meant it made a low-velocity collision with the Earth at a high attack angle. And it fell into the Earth when the Earth had a lot more water than it's got now. And so this planet colliding into the Earth turned all that water into steam and basically broke up the collider and caused the Earth's crust to liquefy, and all the heavy stuff in the collider got sucked into the core of the Earth, and all the white stuff on the surface of the Earth and the white stuff remaining in the collider got blasted into outer space. And most of it was lost to interplanetary space, but enough remained that it solidified into the moon. So that's how the moon formed. So, yeah, go ahead.
When you mentioned the high angle of attack, that this planet was basically in the same plane moving with the Earth and just catching up to it.
Right.
But it didn't strike it on the center line. It struck it up high almost tangentially. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's almost a tangential collision. Not a head-on collision, but a tangential collision hitting into a deep ocean, turning that ocean into steam. By the way, if it wasn't for the ocean, it would have destroyed the Earth. But because there was this ocean, that kind of absorbed some of the collision, turned all that water into steam. Most of the water left and then never returned. And most of the atmosphere of the Earth left and never returned. Earth's atmosphere is less than 1% of what it was before that collision event. Likewise, our oceans are less than 1% of what it was before that collision event. So that goes a long way to explaining why we're so water poor, explains why we have the moon, and explains why we have the element distribution in the interior of our planet, and why we have so much iron on our crust. Yes.
So prior to that event, there was no land mass sticking out of the ocean. It was just more or less...
It was a water world.
It was complete water.
Yeah. And even after the event, our Earth was a water world. So even when the oceans are like only 5 miles deep, it's still a water world. It took plate tectonic activity to convert the basalts at the bottom of the ocean floors into silicates, where those silicates, after a while, build up and float above the basalts. And that, after that goes on for a billion years or so, you get continents popping above the surface of the Earth. So... just like you see in Genesis 1, starts off as a water world, but by creation day 3, you've got large continental land masses on the face of the Earth. Yes?
My question is a bit of a shift from this subject, so I don't...
That's all right. Everybody does that in this class. So
in my study of apologetics, it's easy to get lost in the details, so I look for anchor points. One of the anchor points has always been the Big Bang. Another one has been the anthropic principle.
Yes.
But now as we get into the small physics, what is the quantum physics, I guess, and this is beyond, a little beyond you, but I guess it suggests the possibility of parallel universes. And one of the theories for the Big Bang is it could have been some of these universes bumping into each other. Please correct my description and your response. And so it just goes on and on, the possible scenarios. And so as I understand it, the Big Bang and the anthropic principle both lose a little of their punch in this discussion. And it occurs to me that maybe one of the anchor points goes back to Aristotle and Jewish theoreticians before that and other theoreticians about first cause, that there cannot be an infinite series of causes or you would never get to the current.
Well, let me see if I can capsulize what you're saying. That in terms of scientific evidence for the Christian faith, there are a number of anchor points. You mentioned one, Big Bang cosmology. That's definitely an anchor point. That there's a beginning of matter, energy, space, and time, and a causal agent beyond matter, energy, space, and time.
There are a parallel universe.
That's right. So all this multiverse speculation does not in any way disturb the evidence for a transcendent causal agent. We have a booklet over there written by my colleague, Jeffrey Zwirink, where he makes the point that all models of the universe, all models that would permit the existence of life, whether it be a multiverse or a universe, are subject to the space-time theorems. And so space-time theorems that tell us there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that creates the universe or creates a multiverse. So multiverse speculations do not get around the need for a God. you're still stuck with a need for a God. All they're really trying to do by proposing a multiverse is try to make the point that maybe God exists, but not a personal being. So you don't eliminate God, but it's an attempt to eliminate is a supernatural designing intervention in the course of the history of the universe by suggesting there might be an infinite number of universes, all with different characteristics by pure chance, and we live in the one universe that has the just right characteristics by pure chance. And that's why we had Jeff write that booklet, because he points out that, yes, the multiverse is something that we could possibly disprove, but we can't prove. So in one sense, it's always going to be speculative. But there is a possibility that with more accurate measurements of the cosmic background radiation, we could disprove the atheistic versions of the multiverse. But one of the things Jeff has done a very good job of, he says, let's presume the multiverse is true in the fullest extent of what atheists are suggesting, where you've got an infinite number of universes all manifesting different characteristics. What he points out is if you take the atheistic worldview perspective, the model is fraught with several internal contradictions. So it's a self-refuting hypothesis. But if you take a Christian perspective, there is a way to make it completely self-consistent. So his whole point is, if the multiverse is true, you're stuck with a Christian worldview perspective. If it's not true, you're stuck with a worldview Christian perspective. It works both ways.
What if you got an infinity of gods?
Well, the whole point is, you do need a being that's not subject to space and time. So that sense, the cosmological argument of Aquinas and Augustine stands. So, thanks to the space-time theorems, we know the arguments cannot be refuted. So, anyway, you can read the booklet and get more insight on it.
The booklet and I got more out of your explanation, frankly. I'll have to go read it again.
Well, I do have like a 3-page response and more than a theory. What I did is just say, here's 7 points to consider about the multiverse. And by the way, we have a recorded talk now that we gave at an Anglican church in North Hollywood, where I kind of spoke first and kind of went through those 7 points, then turned it over to Jeff and he went into the scientific details. So that'll be available shortly. So, yes.
You said that God rested on the seventh day and this is his rest.
Right.
Now, when he rests, he doesn't create. Is that correct?
When he's in his rest day, his seventh day, that we see in Genesis chapter 1, that's the period of time when he ceases from his work of physical creation activity. It doesn't mean he's not doing anything. He's very busy doing other things on the seventh day. And this is a point that Jesus made in the Gospels. He says, my Father and I are at work, even though we're celebrating a Sabbath. And the analogy he gave was, he says, all of you feed your families on the Sabbath. What you do is you stop your employment where you get your paycheck, but you still feed your children, you feed your animals. It's not that you don't do anything. You cease from certain activities to focus on other activities. I mean, that's what Sunday's all about. We take a day out from our normal work week in order to focus on the spiritual component of our life. And it's important that we take time off to think about the most important issues of life. I mean, we're all going to die. And are you ready to die? And are you ready to meet your maker? I mean, you know, those are things we need to think about. If people work all the time, then they get distracted. Or if they play video games all the time or watch Super Bowl games all the time, they get distracted. But God is doing things. What he's doing on the seventh day is he's performing miraculous acts to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. The eighth day will not begin until evil and suffering are completely removed from God's creation.
So he's still intervening.
He's still intervening, right.
What was his last thing he did before he rested? Was it the creation of Adam and Eve? Was that his last creation?
That was his last work of physical creation activity, yes, was the creation of Adam and Eve. So with the creation of Eve, we have the beginning of the seventh day. And the eighth day will begin when evil is conquered and permanently removed.
So Adam and Eve were basically created, what, would you estimate 80,000 years ago, 100,000?
Well, I mean, to be really conservative, I'd say something between 50 and 100,000 years ago. Although I think the most probable date probably lies around 60,000, 70,000, somewhere in there. And these dates have large error bars. It wouldn't surprise me if the error bars shift one direction or the other, but approximately in that range of time. We have a little more accurate date on the flood than we do on the creation of Adam and Eve.
So God can basically intervene at any time.
He does.
Can you give me a couple of examples? Well, actually, the Exodus from Egypt, that was a whole intervention.
Well, what I'm trying to get to in this class is that God performs miraculous interventions in the lives of every one of his followers on a frequent basis. Every one of us could write a book documenting all the miracles God performed in our lives. In fact, our publisher is wanting me to write a book where I simply document a few of those in my life as a way to encourage other people to think back. Because it's kind of like what you read in the book of Exodus, where God performed all these amazing miracles for the children of Israel, but after a couple of years went by, they forgot about them. And you know, Moses is saying, you know, keep a record of the miracles God performed on your behalf. Because there'll be times when you're facing doubt and depression, and you need to think back and say, wait a minute, God hasn't abandoned me, because he was there, he was there, he was there, he was there.
How come Christians don't observe the Jewish traditions, since it's sort of a follow-through from that? I mean, the Exodus, the Passover, because that's what Jesus was celebrating, was the Passover. So I'm just curious as to why there's that huge division. I mean,
well, here's why. In the Jewish tradition, the Messiah has not yet come. The redemptive act has not yet been accomplished. And so their celebrations are all focused on those events that point to the future coming of the act of redemption. Whereas in Christianity, we look at Jesus as the fulfillment of that act of redemption. And what you see in the last sermon of Moses, he told the people of Israel, I know you're grateful for the law and you're excited about keeping the law, but the law will not save you. What will save you is the prophet that will come after me. He will provide the gift of redemption. And he says, all these are signs pointing to what God will do in the future. Now, the message you see in the New Testament is similar, where you've got Paul, for example, telling us, okay, Jesus died on the cross for all your sins, but you need to look forward to your future hope. And so Judaism and Christianity are similar in that they're based on the exhortation, okay, God has done great things for you in the past, but you need to look forward to what he will do in the future. And so
don't live in the past.
Don't live in the past. Look at the future. But the difference between Christianity and Judaism is that Christians see no need to celebrate the Passover, because the ultimate Passover act has already happened.
Which chapter was that where Moses said a prophet will come in later on? What book was that?
Book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28 to 32. It's the last sermon that Moses gave before he died.
28 to
32. Yeah, and I would argue it's the most important sermon he ever gave, because he basically lays out for the Jews how God's going to bring salvation and redemption to them. And he also predicted that their hearts would become hard and they would not listen to the message of his last sermon, and that God would have to judge them for their refusal to listen, because they would be depending on the events of the past and not looking forward to the future.
So Moses actually, you would say then Moses actually predicted the coming of Jesus.
He did. He definitely did. And see, Jews accept that. Jews looking at the book of Deuteronomy recognize that Moses did preach there would be a greater prophet than I that would come, and this prophet will be the one that will deliver you from your sins.
But the Jews don't believe it was Jesus.
They don't believe it's Jesus. They believe it's still coming.
Now, did Moses imply that it would be a son of God, of the divine person, or just a human, another human?
Well, what he said of this prophet was that everything he tells you, you must do, because everything he tells you will be the truth and nothing but the truth.
How do we know it's Jesus? That he's...
Well, because what he's telling us is this won't be a mere man. This will be a man with divine attributes. So yes, he did imply it was God himself. Because after all, none of us is capable of saying the truth and nothing but the truth at all times. None of us are capable of expressing love to our fellow man at all times. You know, Moses was saying, this prophet will do those things.
This is all 28 to 32 Deuteronomy.
28 to 32.
That's all I'm going to show him. If I ever see my this rabbi, that, anyways, I like to show him that.
Well, it's a very, I would encourage you to read it for yourself, because it actually predicts what will happen to the Jews in future history. Moses actually predicted that the Jewish people would reject his sermon and begin to trust in their own good works instead. And there would be consequences. And he basically predicted the entire future history of the Jewish nation, including the Holocaust. It's right there in the book of Deuteronomy.
The Holocaust?
Yeah, well, the dispersal, that God would send the Jews all over the world. They would become a byword amongst the Gentiles, saying, you know, they left their God, and this is what's happening to them. But also that God would use the Jews as a tool to reach the Gentiles. So he says it's going to be through the Jewish rebellion that the Gentiles will be reached, and eventually the Jews themselves will be reached. He did say at the end of the story the Jews would be reached. But he said there would be this long period of rebellion. There would be a period that would last many, many generations in which they'd be dispersed throughout the whole world, but God would bring them back to their land. So it actually predicts the rebirth of Israel.
Wouldn't it have been easier just for everybody to get along at the beginning and then...
Well...
Why do we have to go through all the... You know, just Cain didn't maybe murder his brother Abel and everybody was... Everybody lived happily. I mean, why is it always just... I don't get it. Why?
That's a good question. And one I'm actually taking on in my next book, when I deal with Job, is that, and I got a little bit of it in Why the Universe is the Way It Is, that God's ultimate goal is that we would enter into a new creation realm where our free will would be delivered to be able to have far more expression than was possible in this creation. But the only way that wouldn't be a great detriment to humanity is that first we have to go through some testing. And it's kind of like, you know, sending someone off to college. When they go to college, it's going to be hard work. There's going to be testing. There's going to be training. We just heard about this young man going to boot camp. I mean, what's the benefit of boot camp? You come out with discipline, strong muscles, and you have the experience. You know what? I can do this. So everybody who's been to boot camp just says, you know, it is a positive experience because it builds your self-confidence because you have the experience of being challenged and passing the test.
Is it sort of like a parent saying about their kids, well, let him do it, he'll learn the hard way, or, you know, you can't just tell him not to do it. Let him do it, he'll find out it's wrong, and then he'll realize, learn from his mistakes. So is that what we're doing? We're learning?
It's even greater than that. God on purpose is subjecting us to the most difficult test under the most difficult circumstances imaginable in his creation, such that when you come out of it, there's no way you could ever pass a more difficult challenge. You've been through the most difficult challenge.
It's like getting a PhD.
Kind of like getting a PhD, yeah. And, you know, I have this little certificate that says I'll never have to be tested again for my competency in astronomy. Based on the myth, I've been subjected to the most difficult test possible in that discipline, so it's pointless to put me through any more testing. God's doing the same thing with every human being.
And he's tested
all of us. We're all being tested. And there's a reason why the test is so severe. It must be as severe as possible in order that we would gain the possibility of eternal security, where we enter into an eternal relationship with our Creator, where never again, in spite of our free will being expanded in its capacities, of ever choosing an evil pathway ever again.
So God can give you your PhD when you enter heaven. Now have a doctorate of humanity, you're a good poison, come on in, relax, take it easy, you'll have the eternity to enjoy it.
Everything except the take it easy part. It'll be extremely enjoyable and rewarding, but you will not be sitting on a cloud playing a harp. You will have an occupation, but it'll be a very fulfilling occupation. Everybody's going to have a job to do in the new creation. But it's going to be far better than the best job you can possibly imagine. You're going to want to go to work.
Is everybody going to be happy for eternity? Or is it happy, sad, because you can't be happy all the time?
You will be happy all the time. Not bad, eh? That's a pretty good offer. So, no grief, no sadness, no remorse for the rest of eternity. It'll be joy and happiness. Why? Because you've been through the most difficult test. Nothing can ever challenge you again. And you're going to be spending eternity with everybody else who's been through the most difficult test, and they've all passed. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be fellowshipping with one another where everybody here is morally perfect and everybody here is happy and excited and joyful? I mean, that sounds pretty good to me. But that can't happen without God taking us through this most challenging of all tests. To me, what's really most amazing of all is He pulls it off where we only have to live 80 or 90 years. He does it very quickly. I remember going through six-hour exams at the university. I mean, those 6 hours seemed like forever. And that was just a semester-long course. But God is able to prepare us for all of eternity in just a few decades. That's what's really amazing. As far as the human species goes, He pulls it off in 50, 60,000 years. An incredibly short period of time. If you want to know how short, that's 0.0004% of the age of the universe. He makes the conquest of evil happen. Yes, go ahead.
I pick up on the idea of the Sabbath and your quote of John 5:17-20, where God says, Jesus says, I'm working and my Father's working. I can do nothing on my own. It's good advice for us to be humble. I can only see what my Father is doing. To make that practical about the Sabbath and applicable, I talked to one person this morning in this class who sometimes brings up news events and say, well, what can God do about that? And said, can you take this personally and say, what could God do about your life? And something that we ourselves cannot do, that maybe we can never do, and then do our best, and then see what God can do beyond that in a more brilliant plan. And then we see God, not by looking at news events and saying why there's evil and suffering. Proverbs says, take the horse and saddle it and go on to war. And then it says, God gets the victory.
Right.
So these two parts of making it personal and looking at oneself and knowing God by saying, you know, not the news events, but I or something in society that I can become personally involved with has a need, but it's bigger than I am. That's the choice to see God. It has everything to do with the Sabbath. Because we were made on the sixth day to do the work of God, and the rest from creation was with us at the highest point of creation to work with Him to separate goodness from evil.
Right.
And in the Ten Commandments, there's an interesting loop that takes place. The last commandment on coveting says, put at rest your ox and your car, your car in your driveway, or your ox in your driveway, whatever you have, put all these things to rest. That's the same exact list, almost word for word, as what's on the Sabbath to put to rest. So He's telling us, take a rest from ourselves and glorify Me and see what I can do. That's the personal application here.
Well, that could dramatically lower the attendance in this class if all of us put our cars to rest on the Sabbath. But I get your point.
One last thing that would dramatically change the Sabbath would be to go to the scripture that talks about the Sabbath in Isaiah chapter 54. And it says, if you delight yourself and make the delight of the Sabbath and put yourself to rest, and you help people and you do these things, and it gives a list of things to do on the Sabbath, then your darkness will shine as the noonday. And it goes on. But it's about ceasing from ourselves this list of things to put to rest and actually doing something, like we will be in heaven.
Right.
Sometimes on the Sabbath we say, oh, we get to take a vacation. No, we need to take a rest from ourselves and see God work.
Take a rest from ourselves. Take a rest from our busy day-to-day lives, from our employment activity, and all the things that need to be done, and focus on what is our role here for the Lord. I mean, you're right. And if you do it, you'll see miracles in your life. I think that's your point, is that God will perform miracles in your life, and just like those Jews, you'll be able to come up with a list. God did this here, there, and there.
And God will be glorified because people look at you and say, see, you can pull that off. And well, you believe in God, I'm interested in God.
And little tip, the easiest way to see dramatic miracles in your life is to share your Christian faith in the spirit of 1 Peter 3:15 with people around you that don't know Jesus as Lord and Savior. You will see countless miracles. It'll happen. And I think that's your point, too, is that here's the Lord taking a Sabbath to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. But what is his primary instrument in terms of his creation to bring about the end of all evil and suffering? It's not the angels. It's human beings. We are his primary instrument. We are the receptors of his grace. And it tells us in Scripture, 1 Corinthians 6, that the angels are being taught as they watch the grace of God work through us as an instrument to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. So we are his tools. And a lot of what the Sabbath is all about is to make sure that we devote time and attention to the big reason why we're here on earth, to be an instrument in God's hand to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. And by the way, I appreciate what Ralph Winter said more than 20 years ago. He said, you know, we can bring about the end of the universe and the beginning of the new creation anytime we want. Of all of us who are followers of Jesus Christ would simply dedicate ourselves to fulfilling the Great Commission. And his point was, it's achievable in 5 years. So the reason why we're not in the new creation is we Christians are kind of lazy. And we're not paying attention to these commands. And so we begin to take up that task and do it in a joyous way. We can speed things along. So as an extra benefit, if we do speed things along, you don't have to go through the doorway of death. The last generation of Christians gets taken up from earth to the kingdom of heaven in the air, as it says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. So there will be a few that do escape the experience of death, but only those that are alive at the time of the fulfillment of the Great Commission.
Do you want to take a couple of minutes to summarize and finish?
Yeah, you have almost time.
It's almost time? Gee, I wanted to get into this, but maybe that's not practical. Well, I'm trying to figure, am I going to be here next week? I am. Okay, it's after Sunday that I'll be gone for a couple of Sundays. So, okay. And incidentally, with respect to the Skeptics Forum, I talked to our staff. I know I'm not available until August, but I can spring a couple of other scholars free if you want to do one between now and August. So, August 14th and 15th, and they got me on a horrendous travel schedule between now and then. But my colleagues, you know, Fuzz, Ken, and Jeff, and Dave, and we have a visiting scholar now that we could involve. So if you want to get a couple of them to come for a Skeptics Forum, we can make that happen for you.
Can you get Stephen Hawking?
No. See, we only want people doing these Skeptics Forums who currently have a relationship with Jesus Christ. So once Stephen gives his life to the control of Jesus Christ, then, yeah, we can talk to him. But I think his speaking fee is rather significant. So we'd have to pass the plate around here to make it happen. So several times, probably. Okay. When we come back next week, what we've done so far, and we're talking about the origin of physical life in the context of Psalm 8 and Psalm 139, which are the two psalms that deal with the creation of humanity and how we stand in God's position in his creation. And so what I'm doing is first introducing you to the two origins of life that presage the origin of humanity. So it says in Genesis 1, God creates three different kinds of life. Life that is purely physical, life that is physical and soulish, and one species is body, soul, and spirit. So first we're kind of tackling the physical life problem and making this point that atheists have this idea they can explain everything by physics and chemistry. Well, you can't explain the soul or the spirit with physics and chemistry. They've got nothing to do with physics and chemistry. But they do have a case that you could explain the simplest life from physics and chemistry. But as we're taking you through this series, we're pointing out that there really is no naturalistic model for the origin of even life that is purely physical, let alone life that's physical and soulish, for life is physical, soulish, and spiritual. And what we've covered so far is the reason why the Origin of Life community has abandoned planet Earth as a site for the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective. And so now we're going to take you through the astrobiological attempts, which is basically, in terms of Mars, the scenario is this. And I heard this at two Origin of Life research conferences, where atheists stood up and said, we know life cannot originate on planet Earth. Therefore, it must have originated on Mars, and then meteors transported that life from Mars to the Earth. When we get back next week, we'll show you why Mars is not a candidate, and then show you why all the bodies in the solar system are not candidates for naturalistic perspective, and then go out into the other parts of our Milky Way galaxy and see what the possibilities there are. And that's where all the study of extrasolar planets comes in. So that'll be next week. I'm 2 minutes over. Let's bow for prayer so you can all get into your Super Bowl celebrations. Father in heaven, we thank you for this Sunday, an opportunity to celebrate what you have done in creating the universe and coming to our planet, showing us an example of humility so we know how to come into a relationship with you. We thank you that you died on the cross and paid the penalty for all of our offenses against one another and especially against you. And we thank you too, Lord, that in that sacrifice on the cross, you made an offer to each one of us where we could trade our moral imperfection in for your moral perfection. Sounds like a good deal, Lord. I pray you would encourage each one of us to fully partake of that generous offer that you've made. And also, Lord, to put you in charge of our lives, because you know far better than we do what's best for us. So, Lord, give us the humility that we can submit to you fully in order that our character can be transformed into the image of the Creator of the universe, your Son, Jesus Christ. And in his name we pray. Amen.